The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Those in the outer hall, if you're happy sitting out there, you're welcome to stay. But there are chairs in here if you want to be inside here. And I could also say that Diana Clark's day long on Saturday should be quite nice. Diana's done a series of day long, little bit more scholarly studies of Buddhism, of the teachings of the Buddha, the ancient discourses, and she likes to take it on different themes, and kind of explore the theme and in some deeper way what the Buddha actually had to say about certain things. And so this one is on love, which is kind of an unusual topic. And she'll talk about the Brahma Viharas, especially loving kindness, metta, and what it says in the ancient texts. And it'll be a little bit experiential. I think she has in mind that you engage some direct way with it. It's not just a class where she lectures the whole time. And so it should be quite nice. I've taught with her similar things, and she's a really good teacher, and makes it a subject very interesting to listen to engage in. So this evening, it occurred to me to go back to basics and try to offer you some of the teachings of the Buddha, particular teaching of the Buddha, about the most basic or first step in the way that he taught mindfulness. And that first step, because it's the first step, or it's the precursor to being mindful, it's often overlooked or not taught. But it's interesting to look at this kind of first step, or the foundational step before you actually do mindfulness practice, what he says. And so I want to hopefully make this somewhat simple, just a very simple point, just a few words the Buddha has to say that I want to elaborate on. And to do that, I want to introduce that, I want to start by a little analogy. And that is that if you want to leap, jump up in the air, you first have to crouch. Because if you stand on your toes and try to stretch up as tall as you can, and then jump from there, you're not going to go very far. So you crouch, you bend down first, and then you can go up. So you go in the opposite direction that you want to go, right? You want to go up, leap up, but you first go the other way, and then you can jump up, you know, nicely, hopefully. And there's many things in life where, you know, sometimes doing what we think is the opposite direction does the job well. One of the nice things that I'm reminded of periodically is sometimes I'm working at some project, some activity, and I feel like I want to do it, I want to finish it, maybe it's a deadline or something, and so I'm supposed to just kind of keep plugging away when I'm tired. And but if I stop, take a break, go for a walk, do some exercise, take a nap, come back some other time, refreshed, then it goes much faster, it goes much better, it's more clear. So sometimes the way forward is to go backwards. Sometimes the way forward is to do something different. One of the fun places where I saw this was when I was in a monk at the Zen monastery, and I worked in the kitchen. And Zen monasteries are very choreographed places. Or Zen monasteries, so everything has to be in a particular, down to the minute, down to the second, things have to occur. And so serving the food was very particular because they had an elaborate ritual for eating. People ate in the meditation hall, and this elaborate ritual involved people coming in, servers coming in and serving your food in bowls and chanting, and everything was in unison. And so the food had to be served right in time for the dance, for the ritual. You know, you can't do this elaborate ritual to eat, and the food's not ready. Everything has to be on time. So it was kind of intense to make food in the kitchen, especially with this deadline. And every day for lunch was the big meal. I forget when it was, maybe 10 or 15 minutes before serve up, like the most intense time. The rule, or the practice, was everyone in the kitchen had to stop cooking, go to the little kitchen altar, and chant the Heart Sutra, chant this text that takes about, I don't know, 5 minutes or something, 4 or 5 minutes to chant it. And when I first got to the kitchen, I couldn't believe it. You know, I was working away, making the food, and, you know, kind of trying to get out in time. We had, you know, 10, 15 minutes left, and there was still a lot to do, and I was running around. Ding, then rings bell. What? I had to go and stand in front of the altar. This food has to be ready. And it drove me crazy. And the food was always on time. We always had time. We always, somehow, we could, afterwards, we could, somehow, we took the time out. We did this chant. It was beautiful to come together, chant together. There's something very concentrating, settling, people chanting together. And then we go back to our work in the kitchen, and it always came out. And so in this principle of going backwards rather than forwards, to go forwards, I also use in my life where occasionally I feel like I have too many things to do. I feel harried. And there's just, you know, I can't get it all done. And I've learned that if I feel that way, to go and meditate. Not for a long time, 10, 15 minutes. And it sounds crazy, right? I don't have enough time to do all the things. I have so much to do. I don't have enough time to do it all. I can't not, you know, do it. And what I find is that after I meditate for 10, 15 minutes, I always have more time. There's more space. It gives more space because some of the claustrophobic attitude towards getting a lot done is an attitude of the mind. And so if that can settle away, then I can go and do what I have to do more efficiently, more clearly, and I seem to have more space, I have more better sense of priorities. It seems to always work better. So I've learned, you know, so again, it's going in the opposite direction in order to go forward. Isn't that nice? So that's the introduction to this talk. Maybe that's enough. In the ancient discourse called the Discourse on the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, it's a kind of the core text for our tradition. The Buddha gives instructions of how to be mindful. But the first thing he says, you do these things after having put aside greed and distress for the world. So you're first supposed to, that's what you're supposed to do first. Put aside your greed and your distress for the world. And then you focus on your breathing, on your body, on the present moment. You kind of enter and you start doing your meditation or your mindfulness practice. So it's a little bit perplexing why this should be the first thing you do. Some people come to meditate because they're caught up in greed and desire and distress, discontent, hostility, all these things. And they're caught up in it and they realize, I need to do something. I'll go meditate. But then the instruction says, well, before you can meditate, you have to put these things aside. That's like catch 22. Like, you know, what are you supposed to do? You have, just, you know, snap your fingers and it goes away. But I think this is, I've tried to understand these instructions, and I've understood it for myself in this way. Of course, you should put aside greed and distress for the world, if you can, but that's a tall order just to kind of let go of it. We're often kind of so enmeshed and entangled with our thoughts and our feelings and beliefs, stories, that we're so enmeshed that it's hard to just let it go. So sometimes it takes, you see, in the course of a 45-minute period of meditation, some of you probably found that in the first 10, 15 minutes, you were probably much more entangled, caught up in the concerns of the day. But slowly it began to let go, and maybe you got calmer, more settled as the time went along. So it wasn't a process of letting go of the world, you know, a sudden letting go. It was a whole process. It took time. So how I understand this idea is that when we have greed, some people translate this word covetousness. So when we want to acquire things, want things. And when we have distress, discontent, one person translates the word as grief, grief in the world, for the world, upset with how things are in the world, that we have to know that what's happening then is the mind is focused on an object, generally outside of ourselves, something, some event, some person, some event. So if we have greed, like if I'm greedy for this glass of water, it's hard, I think it's almost impossible, or I say it differently, in order to have greed for this glass of water, I have to be thinking about the glass of water. I have to have my attention focused. Even if I don't see the glass of water, I have to be thinking about it, concerned with it, you know, kind of a certain inner desire has to be in the direction of the water. That's what I want. It's an object that I want. If I am upset with things in the world, then I am caught up in the story, the person, the conversation, the event, and I can't just drop it. I'm kind of recalling it. So my mind is focused on something, in a sense, external. Putting aside greed and distress from the world, I understand, is not letting go of the greed and this distress, not letting go of your desire, your addiction, your attachments, or your upsetness, or your despair, or your whatever's going on for you. You don't put it aside when it's hard to do. What you put aside is being interested in the object of your attention. You are willing to disinvest from having your thoughts go into the stories and the ideas. Even that's hard, but at least you have to understand the principle that the way to peace, the way to find yourself at home in yourself, is not found by focusing on those objects, thinking about those things anymore. Without understanding that principle, I don't think it's possible to meditate well. Because because your mind generally, if you're thinking about things incessantly, wanting things incessantly, upset about things incessantly, something inside of you believes that's an important thing to do. Something inside of you invests a lot of your energy into reviewing that and thinking about it over and over again. Something inside of you think that's important to do. What this little teaching is saying, putting aside greed and distress for the world, it's saying when you sit down to meditate or try to be mindful, don't believe anymore that the solution to what you need to do in the moment in order to find yourself at home here in this world, at peace in this world, don't succumb to the belief that you'll find it by somehow fixing the world outside of you. That's not where the answer lies. You might have to think about those things. I mean, I don't want to say you should never think about those things, but it's not the path of the peace of meditation. Without really being convinced that that's the case, your mind will keep going into those thinking. I've got to think about it. I need to come up with a better rejoinder to that conversation I had earlier. I better, you know, figure out how to, you know, who's to blame here. I better, it's good to get worried and get upset and kind of, you know, churn away. And those are important activities. So the idea is to begin to meditate, you have to first give up the belief that it's important to think about things outside of you, things you're upset with and things that you're greedy for. If you give up the belief, the investment in it, then you give yourself a little distance from it, a little freedom from it. It might not be much, but that little bit wedge, crack you form, gives you a little bit of space to start being mindful. if I am so locked into my greed for my water, that's all I can think about, water, 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 you know, there's no space to be mindful. But if I say, you know, I'm not going to find peace through having this particular glass of water, then I kind of a little bit disengage a little bit from it. And in that little bit of disengagement, there's more room for me to investigate, to see more clearly, what is going on here? So that's one way I understand this, putting aside greed and distress for the world. Another, even more important is way of understanding it, is that once you understand that part, and you want to be mindful, start being mindful, it involves doing what I call a 180-degree turn. So say I'm really desirous of this glass of water. Just the water is water, water. I'm thinking water. I don't have to let go of that desire. What I do, as long as I'm thinking about the water, I'm focusing on the glass of water as an object, external to me. What I do is I turn my attention 180 degrees around, so my attention, my awareness, starts paying attention to what it feels like to have that greed for the glass of water. So rather than being objective with the attention, looking at the object of what I want, I bring attention to notice the subject, me, the subjective experience of what it's like to be desiring. And there's a world of difference between feeling the subjective experience of having desire versus chasing the desire. There's a world of difference between being angry and feeling the subjective experience of being angry versus continuing to ruminate about the person we're angry with and how terrible they are, what I'm going to do to them, and I'm going to fix it, and, you know, just whatever. So the idea is to turn the attention 180 degrees around from the object that the mind is concerned with to feel here what it's like to be a person who has this kind of activity going on. And this is a revolutionary turn for some minds. Some minds are convinced it's all about the world, the object, things we have to do. And so this turn, 180 degrees around, does not mean that you have to stop having desires, having the desire, or stop being upset about things. And there's no need to be upset that you're upset. You know, that's just more of the same. You know, if you're upset with yourself being upset, then you're treating yourself as an object. And part of this is understanding we objectify ourselves. And this idea of turning around subjectively is we're no longer objectifying ourselves. We're just there to feel what it's like to be this way. So you don't have to stop being how you are. All you have to do is to feel how you are. So you don't have to stop having desires. You feel what it's like to have desires. You don't have to stop being angry. You feel what it's like to be angry. And that is a big difference, because then you're not fueling the objectification, fueling the discontent, fueling the anger, fueling the desires that we want, what we want. But we're using, because our attention, what we do with our attention is one of the most precious and important things we do in our lives. And where our attention goes tends to feed whatever it's kind of going into. And if your attention is going into being preoccupied, then we're feeding preoccupation. But if your attention goes into being mindfully aware of what's here, then we're feeding greater awareness. So this movement, 180 degrees around, is fascinating to do. And then to feel here, what's happening with me? I would like to propose that it's a very respectful thing to do to yourself. It's taking yourself seriously, taking an interest in yourself in a deeper way. And it's a way of coming home. And for me, it's been very helpful at times to think of meditation practice as a practice of a coming home. And sometimes I even use that little phrase in my mind, come home. Because my mind is capable of wandering all over the world with my eyes closed. come home, you know, come here. And so come back. And so this idea of 180 degrees around, in Zen they call it sometimes taking the backward step. So rather than taking the forward step out into the world, they take the backward step into your direct experience, how it actually feels, what's actually happening for you here and now. And we're often blinded by what's happening here for us if we're objectifying, if we're living in objects of the world out there and things we're concerned with, or if we're objectifying ourselves. So a lot has to do with feel, and this has a lot to do with feeling. So allowing yourself to feel what it's like. So you can feel having greed, having strong desire, compulsion, entangled in wanting something. So now I'll ask you something. Some of you have had a little bit of, just enough experience with, or you know someone who had a lot of experience with desire. Yeah, the neighbor or someone told you, by the way, this, you know. So as you've gone around the world and talked to people and learned a little bit how this stuff works, what have you learned about how, what it feels subjectively like to be in the grips of desire? And it's fine to say it because it, you know, it's maybe your neighbor.
Tight.
Okay. Oh, okay. Tight. What else does it feel? Subjective experience of being caught in the grips of desire. Sorry?
Energizing.
It can be energizing. That's part of the joy of it and delight. Let's go have a good desire because, you know, it gives me life and purpose and, you know, but it's exhausting. You know, and I learned that when I was in my 20s. I used to love going into bookstores, and I'd leave bookstores, and I was always exhausted when I left. So why is that? I was curious. So I started looking. What was going on for me? And I had greed for almost all these titles. I'd go down the shelves, I want that, I want that, I want that. And it was the continuous wanting that was so tiring. So it's energizing, but I think it's at a high cost. Insecure, having been caught in the grip feels insecure. Great.
Discontent.
Feeling discontent. That was the other possible theme today for a talk, was contentment. What else?
Shut down.
Shut down when you're caught up in desire. That's interesting. Your friend who has that, did they say anything more about that? How does that work?
yeah, my friend.
Yes.
And when I'm in the grip of desire, I can't feel where it is in my body. And I'm usually pretty aware when I'm feeling something, where in my body I'm feeling it. But when I'm spinning, I can't feel it.
Great.
I just shut down.
So for the sake of people who didn't hear that, maybe. So she said she's very body aware. It sounds like a place that you like to be. It's very meaningful for you. But when you're spinning out with a lot of desire, you get disconnected with your body and you're shut down there. Great, thank you. So you're not at home anymore.
It's more of a kind of up and down kind of an experience. There's no evenness.
So highs and lows, like get all excited because I'm going to get that, and then, oh no, just out of reach. Oh. And then, there it is, another one.
Yeah, my boss.
Your boss is, oh. I don't think that went into the recording. Yes?
I feel like addictive, like one desire
gets another. Oh. Great. So in ancient Buddhist texts, they talk about monkey mind, with the idea that the monkey mind, apparently, I don't know if it's true for monkeys, but. The monkey union doesn't like this analogy, but the monkey grabs onto a tree to swing, and then how does it work? And then as soon as it grabs one, it's reaching out to grab the next and for the next. And so the idea is we have one desire, but we don't settle for that. We immediately want the next and next. So it can be nonstop. And when my kid was really young, I witnessed once understood that my son sometimes had a lot of desire wanting things. Like you go to Safeway with a little kid, it's not a fun time because of desire. But I saw him once have desire for what he didn't know. He didn't know what he just had a strong desire, but he didn't know what it was for. Because I think I was holding him or something, and he took his hand like he was going to grab something, and he went and grabbed what was behind him. But there was nothing there, but I could feel this intensity. He wanted to have it. But he didn't know what was it, so we can have desire without even knowing what it is. Yes?
Yeah, I don't know how typical this is. The desire can be broader to start with, but it all winds up in my mind. I wind up trying to figure out how I'm going to get what I want or make the world like I want it to be. And it winds up just being completely intellectual after a while.
Great. So if you have a desire, maybe it begins kind of being more kind of connected and alive, but then the more you get involved in desire, it kind of gets coalesces around just intellectual activity and thinking about the object and things, and right?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, and that's kind of a narrower and narrower world. Yes?
When I'm in the grip of desire, I feel out of control.
Out of control when you're in the grip of desire. Yes, there are plenty of people who are out of control. It's very sad sometimes. I hope you've learned something that's useful. Just the fact that you know that speaks well for you. And maybe that knowing that keeps you from being lost in that world. Thank you. Yes?
I just feel unconscious, like there's this force that has entered the mind and that's the only focus. And nothing else matters besides that.
Great. So one more.
I kind of goes off what he said, but in the moment I don't feel this way, but now that I think about it, I think I'm like in a delusion because you always want something like an object, but it's not the desire of that object isn't actually what I'm looking for. If I really get down to it, it's I want this to make me happy, or I don't want this so I don't feel pain, or you know, but I don't think about that.
So, if you're
it's
possible when you're caught in the grip of desire that part of the motivation is certain delusion. So, when you're saying, so that cookie will make me happy forever, or, or those pairs of shoes. If I get those pair of shoes, that'll make my, make me or something. So, that's shoes.
I want to flip it around.
Yes. Nice. Great. So it could well be. So desires for you, say, sometimes is a catalyst for creativity. And yes, absolutely. So what we have to be careful for is not to make all desire a problem now. I try to set it up. The word was greed in the text, right? It's much stronger than desire. And to be caught in the grip of greed, caught in the grip of desire, that's the issue, not the desire itself. And desire can be a very wholesome and important part of human life. And I think some creativity comes from desire. So we have to be very careful how we, what we're talking about here. So I was really talking about when we're locked in. And maybe there's creativity there, but I don't know, maybe it's not, it's like maybe there also we get exhausted. Maybe there's also, there's creativity, but it might also be a disconnect if we're kind of like addicted in doing the thing. And sometimes, I don't know if we want to justify, some people want to justify creativity. No, with creativity, like art and stuff, they want to justify things like being angry or depressed because the great art was created by, these very disturbed artists. so we should all be disturbed and so we can be creative. And, so it'd be a little bit, it's a little nuanced, but the point is good that okay, so thank you for all that. So now the second question is, what happens to all that if you turn yourself 180 degrees around and start tracking what it actually feels like to be that way. What happens to you, you think, when you start actually coming home to the subjective experience of what it's like to be caught in greed? Yes.
There's like contraction and it's frustration and also some discouragement.
So you feel contraction and discouragement, contraction
and frustration.
Say a little bit more. So that's you feel that's part of the desire, or when you stop to take a look, then you're frustrated that you didn't get what you're not getting what you want. Both.
A gripping.
Uh-huh. All right, so you feel that, and what happens when you start feeling it? When you take that into account and feel that, rather than being concerned with what you want, you feel that frustration, that contraction, gripping. It calms it down. So that's a significant thing. Thank you. So someone else? Yes.
When I become aware of the greed, I'm not cut up in the middle of it. There's a part of me that's attached from it, and it's now calmed down.
So you're not. So if you're aware of it, then you're not in the grip of it, and part of you is calming down. Great. So use a little bit of separation. And yes, Gail.
I find that when I let a feeling like, I will say I'm wanting attention and not getting it, and when I let that feeling just be there and feel the hurtingness of it, what arises sometimes is compassion.
Great. So you have desire for attention, you said, and if you turn around and feel underneath that, what to feel underneath that is a sense of being hurt or hurt, right? What you said was
yeah.
Hurt,
yeah.
And if you feel the hurt, rather than want that the attention, then a compassion can arise for yourself. You can have a whole different relationship to yourself,
yeah.
And that's often the case with desire. That strong desires, like strong gripping desires, attachment, greed. Oftentimes there's something underlying it that is actually more important to pay attention to, that's lost if we're caught up in the object. And so if we can actually stop and feel the objective experience, we can start feeling what's deeper and what really needs our attention. Yes. So the hope of desire gives you hope to get out of the place of being suffocated. But if you turn away from the hope, from the desire, then you feel trapped, suffocated. So it's kind of being so you have to acquiesce to it, and you're stuck then if you just kind of feel what's going on. And so what happens to you when you're aware of that and feel that feeling of stuckness with what is here? What happens when you hang out and stay with it, just mindfully present for it?
The suffering gets so, it can all get so unbearable that I want to stop thinking about any of it.
Ah. Oh, I see. So it's very hard for you to stay present for it. The pressure builds so much. Uh-huh. So mindfulness practice was designed to get to the root of that kind of feeling. But it takes a lot of courage to be able to stay with it. And it takes learning how to do the mindfulness practice in a wise way to help understand, to be present in a wisely for that kind of pressure that builds and builds because we're stuck and we feel trapped and we feel like we have to give up all hope for any betterment. We're stuck with a terrible situation. All those subjective feelings can be resolved through the power of mindfulness and being present. And it's quite remarkable to feel this inner change that can happen without the external world changing. And so, but it takes a lot, it takes courage, it takes wisdom, it takes perseverance, it takes time to learn it. But this turning 180 degrees in is the way to freedom. To have that kind of feeling and always be projecting out to hoping and trying and doing, sometimes it's helpful and meaningful, but it also is a dead end. What it'll do is probably just reinforce those feelings. And then we run, then people will run even more and run more and look for something. And some people, as we know, live lives where they're constantly avoiding what's happening for themselves, always chasing after something that's going to do it for fix them and make them better. So I don't know if I'm speaking to your circumstance, but I appreciate very much you spoke about this. Yes?
I find it easier to deal with big desires than small ones.
It's easier to give up big desires?
Yeah, so I can wait for my next promotion, but the afternoon cookie I can't do.
So you can give up wanting a promotion, but the next the cookie you that's on your neighbor's desk you can't give up. Why is that?
It's not conscious. If there's a cookie, it must be eaten.
So if there's a cookie, it's supposed to be eaten. You're not conscious for the desire. So what do you think happens to you if you next time you feel a desire? That's such a strong desire for. I mean, you're only aware that you had the desire for the cookie after you're cleaning up the crumbs. Pretty much. Well, then there's no hope. And then I feel sorry for you because probably you didn't enjoy the cookie.
I found that I don't actually enjoy it.
Yeah, so this is a very important point. So one of the suggestions is that if you have some wherewithal, some awareness of what's happening around the cookie, and you know this pattern, you have this way, these small desires you give into almost subconsciously, unconsciously. If you notice it's happening, commit yourself to sitting still and not moving. And ride out the wave. And ride out the waves mean sometimes desire builds and builds and builds like a, you know, and it comes, you know, it's going to, the wave's going to, but sooner or later the wave breaks and you find yourself on the other backside of the wave. And sometimes it's like the rodeo to sit still and not move, not give in to the desire, because desires are come with a whole big cast of lawyers, public relations agents, advertisers, scientific experts, about why you have to have that cookie now. And so you have to, or it can be even worse, the whole slew of doctors will come in and say, if I don't have that cookie now, terrible things will happen. So you have to not listen to the inner voice and commit yourself to not moving. And stay there, don't move until you find yourself on the other side. And that's extremely empowering. It's very encouraging for people who do this, people who are addicted. It's very encouraging to see that they have the ability to ride it out, not give into it. And you might learn a lot about yourself, and you might learn a lot about what the unconscious is all about if you don't give in and ride it out. Just sit, you know, and, you know, put on the seatbelt. You know, And you know, you could, I mean, I've known people who've done this as an exercise where they go buy a bag of cookies and they put it on their desk. They put it all out there, put it on a plate, everything's ready, and then they sit and meditate with their eyes open and they're not going to give in. And in that, some people need to do this exercise because it's so powerful, these desires. And so, and then you sit there and try to really track and understand what's going on and get to the bottom of it and learn how to be stronger than the cookie. Yes?
Do they eat the cookies like 20 minutes later?
I mean, what happens to that plate? They throw it out? What's the end game for that?
I think, yeah, you donate it to your neighbors. Because one of the tricks of the mind is very tricky. So one of the tricks of the mind is you succeed in avoiding the temptation that you know you shouldn't be doing, and then you kind of, oh yeah, I did it. Great, and you let down your guard, you relax, and you grab the cookie because you know you're not paying attention anymore. So you have to be very careful about the afterwards. You know, you're not lower your guard. Or wow, I did really good. I deserve a reward. But you know, you could eat the cookie. You know, you might be so hungry after that. You know, it's been such hard work, and you know, you expended so much energy that, you know, okay, maybe it's okay. Yeah, or you need the cookie. Cookies are okay. So, yes.
I find myself, especially lately when I become aware, that it's really a waste of my energy, mental energy and emotional energy.
So when you start becoming aware of what it's like to be thinking about desire, you realize it was just a waste of your time, waste of your energy.
Yes.
And when you realize it's just a waste of time, that understanding, how does that shift things for you?
Well, first of all, I use a lot of humor. There I go again.
Uh-huh.
I'm wasting the precious present moment.
Uh-huh. So, and that frees you a little bit to come back to the present in a more, in a better way.
Yes.
Great, lovely. That's nice, that's wisdom.
But then it comes back again.
Yeah, but you have to practice. We do it over and over again. Yes, please.
Trying to meditate, and one day I flipped. I just went, why are you spending all this time and energy on this? And I just sat there, and I sat there for hours just looking like in a mirror.
Yes.
And I can only say it was like a miracle.
Uh-huh.
It all went out.
Great.
In like a couple of hours, but it dissipated.
Beautiful.
Just, I looked and said, this is a waste of my life. And not, it has no purpose. It has no end game.
Great.
And,
so wonderful.
It was huge freedom.
It's wonderful. So you felt all this anger for years, but when you finally stopped and looked at it, you know, why am I doing this? And just stayed with it and felt it like a mirror looking at yourself. Then over some hours, it just dissipated.
And it was freedom.
And it was freedom. Yes. So this is a very powerful process. This idea of turning 180 degrees around and really tracking and feeling what's here, the subjective experience, that allows for some deeper process of healing, of resolving, of opening, of freeing to occur. That cannot occur if we stay caught up in the object what we want and what has to happen or what we're angry with. It actually, if we stay caught up in what we want and what we hate and what we're upset with, it actually limits the innate capacity to move towards freedom and release. And love, yes. So you love him now? Oh. Last one, thank you. Last one, yes.
Maybe this is intuitive and I don't realize it, but how would you suggest finding equanimity when you desire something that you have to have? I mean, like food, beyond just a cookie, you have to eat. You
I think if you're suffering, then something is, you're adding something extra that's not needed. Now,
I've noticed that there are different layers of suffering.
Oh, absolutely. There's
very low level suffering, like it would be nice to, you know, be a piece of bread or something. And then maybe a little higher than that, it would be really nice to have a cookie or something. And as you kind of take away the higher ones, lower ones come up a little bit.
Let me say this, pick up on what you said in the beginning. There are desires we have which are reasonable and important. So if we're hungry, and starving perhaps, it's important to eat. And if you can eat at the right time and place and the right food, not your neighbor's cookies, without asking, then please, by all means. But, there are circumstances in life where even our basic needs sometimes cannot be met. And we live in a pretty privileged society, and so it's relatively easy for us to get many of our needs met. But even in our society, situations can occur where a basic need, a desire for a basic need, cannot be met. And so what do you do? And so do you have the ability to be free in that circumstance? You started by asking how to be equanimous. Do you have the ability to be equanimous, be at peace, to be settled, be content, be relaxed, being uncomfortable, being hungry? And traditionally in Buddhism, this is part of the training, because you cannot be free if you're only free when you're comfortable. You cannot be free only when, because your desires are fulfilled. And so, of course, if there's a real need, something that's really important, ideally we get it met with. But there's, life, there's no guarantee in life that it'll all be, So it just means a little bit going a different direction. But for example, pain. It's good. If you have physical pain, it's good to try to avoid having it. It's not good to have physical pain for the body. So if you can avoid having it or causing pain, or if you can, it's a good way sometimes to, alleviate the pain. It can be good to do that. But you might come to a situation in your life where you have pain and there's no hope for alleviating it. And so do you have the strength and the freedom of the mind to sit there and experience that pain and keep the mind relaxed, unagitated by that pain? And the goal of mindfulness practice is certainly to be free, but freedom is a hugely powerful thing and includes learning to be free, at peace, when we're in pain, when things are not going the way we want, when, we're sick and we're dying in an uncomfortable way. What is it like to be free there? To only know how to, to be comfortable in this life, to feel at home in this life, when everything is going well, is not real freedom. So putting aside greed and distress for the world. So first it means that when you sit down to meditate, you at least understand the principle that the path of meditation, the path to peace, is not found by continuing to think about what you want or continue to think about what you're upset about. There has to be some, you can't necessarily stop doing it, but you at least know that principle is true, so you don't quite believe that that's the solution. And then if you can take the next step, you can turn your attention 180 degrees around and come back and feel your subjective experience of what it's like to have this strong desire, to have this strong upsetness, and then feel it. And then the rest of the instructions that the Buddha gives for mindfulness, be with your breathing, breathe with it, feel your body, feel what it's like in your body, open to your body as you feel this stuff. Become aware of your feelings, become aware of the mind states that are really present here underneath it all, and become aware of some of the underlying ways in which your mind operates that brings suffering or brings happiness. These become available to you. This is the instructions to go deeper and deeper into yourself, so you come more and more at a home to yourself. And that's kind of, the city of really being at home in yourself. And if you find yourself really at home, this inward journey that mindfulness meditation is about, then if you do it really well, then you've crouched really well. And then you're ready to leap out into the world, to come back into the world. In Zen, they say, with gift-bestowing hands. Then you have something, you can come back to the world. So it's this is not about disappearing, withdrawing, or denying the importance of being in the world. But it's strategic. It's very helpful to come home, be at home here. Learn how to be at home here. And then with that, you can come back and so much in the world goes a lot better that way. So, thank you.